From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. In February 1974, Patty Hearst, the granddaughter of William Randolph Hearst, was kidnapped by an organization called the SLA in what became one of the most bizarre chapters of American crime as well as American popular culture. William Grabner puts it in perspective in his new book, Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. William Grabner is a historian and the author of lots of books. So, William Grabner, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. It's great to be on.
Well, let's first, you know, for the youngins, let's review the story. So, February 4th, 1974.
Right. Well, Patty is living with her fiancé, Stephen Weed, in a kind of an ordinary Berkeley townhouse. She's violently kidnapped, thrown in the trunk of a car. Stephen Weed is hit with a rifle, I think, in the face, ends up in the hospital, and spirited away. A few days later, the SLA, Symbionese Liberation Army, takes responsibility for the kidnapping. A few days after that, they release one of the first Patty Hearst tapes, which they make with the SLA makes with her cooperation. She's put in a closet, and she pretty much stays in a closet, blindfolded for a couple of weeks, but in the closet for about 8 weeks. And then in early April, she presumably, according to the SLA and on the tapes, one of the tapes that they release, joins the SLA. She agrees. She gets an offer to join. They ask her if she wants to join, and she says yes. On April 15th, she's photographed by cameras at the Hibernia Bank in San Francisco, participating in a bank robbery. With a gun over her shoulder, and she makes an announcement that, you know, this is Patty Hearst, so that people will know who she is, because she's wearing a wig. A few weeks later, the SLA moves to Los Angeles, I think, because there's just too much heat in the Bay Area. And a week after that, roughly in mid-May, there's a fire at the SLA safe house, and six members of the SLA are killed. Some people think Patty might be among them. She's not. She's off with Bill and Emily Harris. They're a combat team, and they happen to be shopping during, the day that this event takes place.
So it was just a coincidence that they weren't in the house.
That's right.
In other words, the police who charged the house had no compunction about killing Patty Hearst among all the others.
Well, that certainly was a reasonable lesson, because nobody knew whether she was in the place when the fire took place. So the sense was they were willing to. It looked as if it was pretty clear that they were willing to kill her if that was what was required to stop the SLA.
Well, let me just interrupt the narrative for one second to ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
The 1970s was kind of the tail end of an era of political action for young people. I mean, the draft had already ended, so it wasn't quite what it had been, in the 1960s. But and Nixon was kind of already on his way out. But the SLA kind of gave the impression that they were one of these young political action on-campus groups. But really, who were the SLA?
Well, they weren't really I wouldn't call them an on-campus group. I don't think they had any real campus. They weren't really campus-oriented. They were founded in 1972-73 by young people who were into prisoners' rights and were involved in visiting prisoners. So they're a combination of the people that they met in the prison, and themselves. I mean, this kind of, and I suppose one of their major focuses was prisoners' rights. That's really where they come from. That was a major movement in the early 1970s, not just for them, but just sort of nationwide. But you're right that this is a period when one gets some of the excesses of the 60s, not just the SLA, but the Weathermen and cult movements, and it's almost as if most people have given up on the standard reform movements of the 60s. I mean, the 60s are over; they understand that, but there are some diehards here who are not willing to give up and who are extremists.
So Patty Hearst avoids being killed with the rest of them, and so then what happens?
Yeah, she does. Well, she spends the next year. She actually crosses the country, and she spends a summer, maybe a little more, on two farms in Pennsylvania and New York, in rural parts of these states, with Bill and Emily Harris, and Wendy Yoshimura, who is not part of the group but shares some of the values, and then she returns to the West Coast, I guess, like a moth to the flame, in a sense, with
a salmon spawning
with the Harrises and Yoshimura, first into Sacramento, and then finally into the Bay Area, and she's arrested and finally found by the FBI on September 18th, well, 1975. And her trial begins actually 2 years after she was kidnapped on February 4th of the following year, 1976.
So actually on the anniversary of her kidnapping, the trial.
Yeah, her trial starts, right,
Before we get to the trial, the period of time where she was at large, I guess it's about a year then that she was...
Well, it's called the missing year, and it's sometimes used to refer to the 15 months after the Los Angeles fire, before she was arrested, or sometimes just the year before she was arrested, but the missing year. Right?
And your book, which is a lovely, the graphics on the book are great. The way it's produced is really nice. And on the front cover, on the dust cover, are these pictures of Patty. They look basically like her high school yearbook picture or something, with a variety of wigs and glasses.
Yeah, they were taken from, a picture that was taken of her and Stephen Weed, and they took this, kind of cropped this out of the picture, and then they put these wigs on her to, like the FBI will do, to show how what she might look like, because the SLA was into disguises, and they'd wear wigs
and
all the time. And
the FBI actually had Patty Hearst on their most wanted list.
They did, yes.
As a criminal.
Yes, as a criminal. That's correct. And the Justice Department talked about her as a criminal very early on in this process, which is one of the things that made her afraid, afraid not just of what the SLA might do to her, but afraid of what the FBI might do to her.
We're chatting with historian and author William Graebner, and his book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. Well, so she was finally captured and she stood trial. Let me ask, how would you place this case, in terms of media attention? So there's Leopold and Loeb and the Lindbergh kidnapping and the Manson murders and O.J. Simpson. Where do you think this fits in that?
Well, I think these are all huge, huge media events. I'm not sure I know enough about these, enough about media events to measure the difference. But it was, a media circus for 2 years. She was on the cover of Newsweek 7 times, if you can imagine that, for example. So it's after Watergate, there's some time for people to digest this case, but there's enormous interest in it.
Well, one of the things that I'm interested in, and maybe I'm the only one, I'm interested in Stephen Weed's mustache. It's one of the most bizarre mustaches in history, but you probably don't know much about that. But what about Stephen Weed? What was his reaction to all of this, her fiancé?
Well, he thought he would come back to her, that they would reconcile, and of course they never did. I mean, she went on to marry her bodyguard after she got out of prison in 1979. He also, at least according to one of the books, spent a great deal of time with the family, and inserted himself, according to one author, inappropriately in their reflections about what was happening. But to be fair, I mean, what can he possibly do? Besides worry like everyone else.
Naturally. So, all right, so tell us a little bit about the trial. She was on trial from February.
Yeah. Well, what interested me about, one of the things that interested me about the case from the beginning was the amount of attention devoted to psychiatry and psychology in the trial. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I got attracted to the case. On the one hand, I mean, there was an enormous amount of attention placed on this. Weeks of the trial were testimony from psychiatrists about some version or another of brainwashing. You know, this notion that she had somehow been changed in some mental way by her captors, or what the psychiatrist called a coercive persuasion was the word. But one of the psychiatrists mentioned that actually to make this case, it's pretty interesting because to make this case, they had to use analogies. I mean, it's hard to, how do you prove that somebody was brainwashed? Well, you prove it partly by showing what she went through, the closet, the abuse, the lecturing, the fear, the fear she felt for her life. On the other hand, you show how people in difficult situations historically have bent under the similar circumstances. So you look at the most famous case studies where pilots during the Korean War, some of whom broke under pressure and said things that that they shouldn't. Cardinal Mincenti was brought up in 1948. He was imprisoned by the communists and made a confession. The Vietnam POWs were brought up as by another psychiatric witness, and the victims of the Nazi concentration camps. So here we have all of these, you know, used as, this is what happened to these, all of these victims, the same thing the psychiatrist argued happened to Patty.
And who were her lawyers?
Well, her main lawyer was F. Lee Bailey. He took over from others, but he handled the defense, did the opening, did the closing, and he was only 43 at the time, but already he was well known for some really really important cases, including the Boston Strangler, and he'd been involved in the defense of the My Lai
the My Lai massacre,
you know, the My Lai defense, and so forth.
So those are famous cases that he lost.
I don't think. That's a good question.
Yeah.
He had one of these. He had lost. He was generally successful in his career, though.
Uh-huh. So he pled. Obviously, he pled her not guilty by reason of brainwashing.
Well, he didn't actually. What after all this, you know, the brainwashing defense. He almost drops. At the end of the case, you know, I mean, shocked to read the trial transcript, because he barely brings these people up at the end. I think realizing that somehow this isn't washing with the jury, that they don't like it, and he turns to something that's a bit different. He turns to this concept of survival, that all she wanted to do was survive. Not that she was brainwashed, you know, but that she was fully functioning and simply wanted to do everything she possibly could to stay alive, which is a slightly different defense.
Right.
Yeah.
And was the Stockholm Syndrome brought up into that case?
No, it wasn't.
Nope.
No. In fact, I was surprised. It's not mentioned in the case, although it goes back to the 1973 and the Swedish bank robbery, where the robbers held people for, I think, 115 hours, and there was enormous identification of some of the captors with the people who were with the bank robbers. But
but
it doesn't really become a phenomenon in the States. I can't find any real mention of it in the mass media until 6 years later in 1979, and scholars really don't discuss it until 82. So now it's interesting, you know, whenever Patty's brought up, you know, the Stockholm Syndrome is brought up, but that was
not at the time.
But not at the time, and I think it wouldn't have worked in her case. I mean, because, you know, they were the defense was unwilling to say, look, she really identified with these people deeply. She said she didn't.
And she did testify at the trial.
She did testify. Yes. Yeah. That's right. In fact, at the trial, oddly enough, she denied that she'd been brainwashed. and actually gave, I think, fairly effective emotional testimony. The public seemed, at least judging from newspaper editorial, seemed to gravitate to her during her testimony, you know.
Well, I guess the big question that anybody would want to know, if I were on the jury, is, you know, after the fire and the death of Sing Q and the other SLA members, and she was just with William and Emily Harris, why didn't she get away? Why didn't she call the police?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. That certainly was disturbing to the jury. They noted that in interviews afterwards. You know, the closing of the prosecution also noted that she had failed to escape, and it would have been easy enough, actually. You know, she could have. She was alone a lot. Certainly had access to a phone when she was by herself frequently.
Well, did William and Emily Harris hold her?
No, they didn't. Her defense was that she just couldn't do this. She was so fearful that something would happen, that something would happen, that they would find her if she escaped, they would kill her. If not them, somebody else who they knew would kill her. And, of course, she continued to fear the FBI, that it wasn't a matter of simply running into the friendly hands of the authorities. It was the possibility that even then, even the FBI might be dangerous, might be dangerous to her life.
Well, you know, it would seem that once she was caught and put on trial,
right,
that anybody on a jury would say, look, you know, she's a teenager. She was held under these extreme circumstances, frightened. How can you take a kidnapped victim and find them guilty? So I'm sure
that's right. That's what her mother thought, and that's what a lot of people thought. It's kind of the but-for. It's called the but-for argument. But for the kidnapping, she would have never been in the bank to begin with, and she was, of course, being tried for bank robbery. How can you now convict her of bank robbery, a bank robbery that took place not much more than 2 months after she was kidnapped? And that raises another point, which is that the judge did allow some material after the bank robbery to enter into the case. And the most important event was a shooting that took place at Mel's, which I described in the book briefly, mm-hmm. but it was a really important event. Do you want me to?
Yes, please do.
Yeah. Well, this was like the day before the Los Angeles fire. She's down in L.A. She's her combat team, which was her and Patty and Bill and Emily Harris, were out in the VW van, and they went shopping at a sporting goods store on Crenshaw Boulevard in Los Angeles. And they pull up the van across the street. Bill and Emily Harris get out, go across the street, and go into the store. And they leave her there. I think Patty's reading the paper, and she's got four guns in the van. The next thing she knows, Bill Harris is struggling on the sidewalk with one of the employees of the store. He had stolen a small object, gotten caught, tries to leave the store, and the clerk pounced on him, and they're wrestling around on the ground. So Patty grabs one of the automatic rifle in the van and starts spraying the facade at Mel's across the street. This is like a six-lane highway, you know, between the park, between the van, shooting out the window. When all the bullets are gone from that gun, she picks up the regular rifle and starts shooting with that. Of course, you know, everybody ducks for cover. Bill Harris, Bill and Emily get away, and they take off in the van.
No one was injured.
What?
No one was injured.
No one was injured. That's right. That's
mm-hmm.
right.
But of course, you know, when you start spraying bullets, you could easily shoot somebody.
You could easily, and Patty was no expert with a weapon, so she did. She had to explain this after the bank robbery conduct, and the judge allowed it on the grounds that it colored, you know, in some ways it informed the jury about. Her state of mind during the robbery.
Even course. Though she wasn't ever charged with firing a weapon or anything like that?
Not in that particular case, no.
Right.
Yeah. So this was bad. There are lots of other things, too, but this was difficult to explain. She tried. she claimed that, in a sense, actually, in this case, that she had been brainwashed. She said, this is what they taught me to do. This is what they told me to do, and if I didn't do it, they'd kill me. I mean, it's some combination of her arguing that she'd been trained to do these things and, on the other hand, was afraid of the consequences of not doing them.
Well, we're talking with William Graebner, and his book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. And it's a wonderful book, but your book doesn't answer the questions like, what was Patty doing with the gun, and why was she doing it, and was she really Tanya? I mean, we don't really get the definitive answers.
No, you don't. No, that's not really what the book is about. The book is about, as the subtitle suggests, I told the story because I thought it's not really fair to interpret something, to say this is what it means,
right,
if you don't have the story in front of you. So you need the story. But my emphasis was not on digging up new facts to resolve the issue of what was in Patty's mind. I don't think that's possible, actually. As I explained in the book, I don't think it's possible to know that. I mean, she said, I don't know what happened to me, and I think that's probably about as far as we can get. We really don't know what happened to her. We're not going to know it. And what to me is interesting is that Americans are just fascinated with this. And my focus was, you know, how come? You know, what do they care about here? Why is this an important event? I mean, there's some obvious answers to that. She's a kind of a minor celebrity, you know, rich girl, big name, Hearst name. But beyond that, I thought there were more interesting answers to that, and that was my focus. That was my focus in writing the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we think of the 1970s, and it was a very transitional decade in that it was the period in which the revolutionary changes of the 60s were kind of being absorbed into society. The baby boomers sort of took their place in society beyond college and so on. The women's live movement and all that. And it was a time in which the younger generation that gathered on campus was not so much protesting to affect change, but there was giant crowds, you know, watching Streakers and and then cocaine came along, and Deep Throat, and Pet Rocks. So how do you think the Hearst case fits into that puzzle?
Well, I think you're right to call it a decade of transition. It certainly was in all kinds of ways. And in the way, I guess the way I approach it, I would think about it is that, you know, if she'd been arrested. The same thing had happened to her in 1965, she would have been found innocent. The same thing had happened in 1985, she would surely have been found guilty, and it wouldn't have taken much time. What's interesting about the case is it's right in between. You know, it's in the mid-1970s. The trial's held in 1976, when the nation, the culture, is really in transition from one set of values to another, you know, from, you could say, you know, Lyndon Johnson liberalism or something, and that's part of it, to Reagan conservatism, and she's right on the cusp of that. Unfortunately, the case is a little late, and it results, I think, in some sense, the case is political in that sense. She's tried as these new values are coming into place, and she's not a part of that. She's identified with the 60s, you know, with permissiveness, for example, with as a 60s radical. As the spoiled rich kid of the 60s, you know, this kind of thing, as a terrorist of sorts. But that's you know, so that's the fulcrum right there. She's in the middle.
So she served a certain amount of time in prison. How long was she actually in prison? She was found guilty and served how long?
She served, I think, a little less than 3 years. Her sentence was commuted in 1979 by President Carter, and she was pardoned by Clinton at the end of his...
One of the people that he pardoned at the very end of his presidency.
Yeah.
And she's still, of course, alive and well. And
she is, as far as I understand. She's living in New York. She makes an occasional movie with John Waters. And seems to be still living with the bodyguard, the ex-bodyguard, and seems to be, from what I hear, happy.
Well, let's hope so. She deserves to be.
Yes.
Well, the book is called Patty's Got a Gun, Patricia Hearst in 1970s America. There's a lot to it, and we've just scratched the surface of it. And William Graebner is the author, and thank you for spending some time with us today on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show. I'll be back again soon with another great program. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. As always, thanks go to our From the Bookshelf production staff, Miss Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.